Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. I'm joined by my co-host, Rob Greenlee. Rob, good morning. How are you?
Doing terrific. It's sunny in Seattle today, so everything is a little cheery, and spring is definitely arrived. It's supposed to be in the mid-70s next week, so you know, it's up, but I'm only up here half the time anyway, so
well, that's,
I'm only going to see half of it.
You know, the 70 degrees is like a regular heat wave in Seattle, so...
It is the shorts and the you know swimming suits come out at about 70. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Hey, take a second and if you want to introduce our guests, and then I want to backfill you on a couple things that we've got going on. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. We're joined by Bob Kernan, who's with a company called Jake Apps, and they are a big app provider in the iOS and the Android ecosystem, and just wanted to have Bob on the show to really kind of share his thoughts on what's going on in the world of apps and how that might, he can share also some of his thoughts and his company's opinion about apps in the podcasting space and the kind of new media world. So, Bob, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on today. And, you know, this has been apps in the new media space has been a discussion point with Rob and I for a while. And I'm looking forward to have this conversation. Bob's got about 45 minutes, Rob. So just so you know, we're on the clock with him this morning.
Yep.
And, but first thing I wanted to do though, before we get it deep into the conversation is, the progression, Rob, of the, I guess for a better words, the rollout of the new website, continues. We're working on the back end movement of stuff. I've had, being 10 years in the new media space, in the beginning, my media was kind of like all over. And so I've been basically taking care of the back end infrastructure. We've been sending a lot of media to S3, and basically it's going to be served up by CloudFront, and just a whole bunch of stuff going on with the back end. I guess for a better word, infrastructure. And when we roll the new site out, this baby's going to flat out scream. You know, we're doing things like separating the database from the server, putting it over in another location, and really trying to maximize the performance of the website and offloading media. And just a hope in all the stuff that I probably should have done 5 years ago, but when you're busy, you know, and it's but it's time for that major remodel. So it is in work, and the template is finally in design, getting cut, I guess, for better words, by the designer. So I don't know. I've got my fingers crossed here that we're going to make progress, but we just had a bunch of contracts come in last week. So I don't know. I think maybe I'm going to have stuff stacked on Angelo for a couple more weeks here as we execute those. It's good. It's a good thing to be busy, yeah?
Yeah, no, it's all exciting stuff. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to the new website and getting everything pulled together into one kind of show experience. And I think it'll be really, really good for all the viewers of this show. And we can really, you know, share more content and make it a more seamless experience, I think.
Yeah.
Should be good.
And a segue to that is, you know, I've always, you know, I get asked by, you know, my regular show, Geek News Central audience from time to time, are you going to do an app? Are you going to, you know, what are you going to do? You know, how come you haven't done an app? And oftentimes I have to, and I don't know. I know the way I use my phone, and I use the podcasting app on iTunes, you know, basically the podcasting app that comes with iOS. And yep. I don't use other shows' apps. So I'm thinking to myself, if I don't, and I'm a podcaster, if I'm not using other shows' apps, do I really need a show? Do I need one for this show or for Geek News Central, or do I need a network? And maybe that's where Bob comes in. And, you know, I've got web content, we've got video, we've got audio, we do all kinds of promotional stuff. So I've got all the, like, I think the stuff that would make up a good app, but I don't know. I'm doubtful. Convince me.
Okay. I'd be happy to. I convince people for a living. I think the key thing with apps is you have to have a – it's really about the brand. And it's the content is important, but the content is just part of that brand. And I think that, you know, if the Geek News Central brand has clearly a lot of content, I mean, you've got podcasts. I'm sure there's other elements that you would want to share. It really does actually make sense to have that, because the thing about an app is the most important thing an app gives you is right off the bat, you have some what our founder Paul Jacobs calls beachfront property. You're not anymore. You're not subjected to, you know, being found on the mobile web or in some other environment. You're very much right there on that user's palm top. And that's really important, because if you have that, then you're able to really bring your content to that audience that has a passion for what you're doing. I think one of the other real element, in addition to content beyond, you know, we always tell our radio stations, we have about 350 radio stations for whom we provide apps. And what we always tell them is it's not just about your linear audio stream. It's about everything else you do. It's about your social media. It's about all these other elements. And so the first thing you want to do is have all of those elements. And the second thing you want to do is you need to have an audience that's passionate. The more passionate your audience is about what you do, the more likely they are to want to download your app. And that's really the way we approach things at JCAPS, is what is that, what is that combination? What is that formula of elements that comes together that will make your app successful? And that's something where we really feel very, very passionate about, because we see a lot of people who have, you know, some people who have big audiences don't have passionate audiences. And sometimes people with smaller audiences have extremely passionate audiences. And, you know, somebody I worked for a long time ago, you know, said to me once, they said, there's two ways to make $100. You can get $1 from 100 people, or you can get $10 from 10 people. And I think that where apps can really bring a lot to a brand is when you have that passionate audience.
You know, Rob, it's kind of funny, because he says about five things there that I've been telling podcasters for the past 10 years. Own your brand.
That's true.
Own your brand. You know, this is funny. It's going full circle. And then, you know, some audiences are passionate, some aren't. Yeah, I tell that to media buyers all the time. You know, so yeah, there's a lot of things that resonate there. I think from a... And I try to take the view oftentimes of the listener, and you know, I really try to understand their, you know, their psyche and how they work and how they're interacting with their mobile device. And that's been my biggest, I guess, my biggest hang up. You know, it's like I'm not drinking my own medicine here, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, they tell me how they're using their phones, and it just, you know, kind of makes me go, you know, I don't know if I'm 100% convinced. You know, there's definitely, in the early days, there was the cool factor, and, you know, maybe we've moved way beyond the cool factor, and it's not the cool factor anymore. It's an absolute need. But, you know, we look, you know, I don't know exactly how much you know about what I do really on a day job, but, you know, we look at statistics on podcasters. And I know really that the percentage from a global point of view of looking at, you know, very, very high level, looking at across maybe 20,000 shows, 25,000 shows, is that I know what the app usage is. And that's still what internal in my head makes me kind of, I don't know if I want one for my own show. Rob, you know, I know you want to jump in here. I think apps are critical for certain shows, but I don't know if it fits for all shows personally.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a gradient here, and I think apps make sense for some, and I think apps may not make sense for others, and it's not a clear yes or no answer. You know, I threw a question out on Twitter yesterday. You know, podcasters, do you think you really need, or do you get value from having a standalone app for, you know, like all you put out is a audio podcast. And most of the people that came back on Twitter said that they felt that they didn't need an app, and that it was a waste of money. But I didn't ask a very complex question. I was looking for kind of a knee jerk reaction, right? Then I got a couple of tweets from other podcasters that said, having my own app has been great. And how that really has worked out well for them is around bonus content. And I think this comes back, full circle back to what Bob was just saying. And Todd, you've also been saying is that an app needs to have a depth of content in it. And for it to engage with an audience, it needs to have value. It can't just be the same thing that they can get in iTunes or in the podcast app. It has to add more value. It has to have something that engages and offers more for a, kind of like what a website did. And I think that what we're seeing happen is that the app side is starting to, and has been moving this direction for a while, it's kind of replacing people's website usage. And as we think about, all these new devices that are coming out and that are going to come out, the whole desktop side is disappearing. People are going to use their mobile devices like their desktops, but everything is going to desktops, which means I think over time that the web is going to be more and more replaced by apps. And I think if you want to have a significant presence in this world, I think you have to have an app, but I think you have to think about more than just putting out an app with audio in it.
Rob, I'll go.
The other things that I would add to that, one of the things that apps are really big on is they have to have utility. There has to really be something there for that audience to use, because there's not the way people use their phones is as a device to get tasks done. I mean, you know, people go through and they check things off their list. And I think that's something that, if you have regular news, if you have information about the topic, of the media you're creating that you can give to people, I think that's a really important element, is to have that utility.
And I guess, where my devil advocate part comes in here, and I'm going to play that today, if you haven't noticed already, is to me, from what I see from shows that have apps, I really look at the justification too, because I look at the numbers, irregardless of how people are consuming it, most people are still using some default podcatcher apps on the devices in a large majority. And we've publicly said this before. We look at the Stitcher app. Stitcher has got a huge presence. They're moving into the car. They've really got a great marketing thing, and still they hold 3%, maybe 4% of the total downloads that's actually coming from Stitcher. So irregardless of, they got this great presence, the views and the listens are not being driven by them. And, don't get me wrong. I love that 4% that's listening over there. So, we had this strategy when set-top boxes first came out, when Roku came out, I said, we got to be on Roku. We were like app number 26 or something on Roku. We were one of the early ones and spent a lot of money. It's easy now to get on Roku. A lot of developers, there's 400 plus, channels on Roku. So, I'm a big believer in distribution. So, I guess from a utility standpoint, if I'm just going to decide to move forward and have, a very robust app, it's from the utility point of just another distribution point, not necessarily looking at it from, if I can get beyond the numbers. And that's my problem. I'm a numbers guy, and I look at everything from is this gonna make sense dollars and cents wise? One of the guys in the chat room, actually one of the longtime fans of my show on here, did me a demo app on Android back in 2010. Now, we didn't promote it a lot, and that app got about 500 downloads back in 2010. So a number of people did download it and grab it, which is, you know, I guess a percentage. You know, it's a percentage of a percentage of the audience, obviously, but some folks did grab it. So, you know, maybe there's more there than what I haven't given it enough credit.
We always tell our clients, our radio station clients, be everywhere. You know, obviously we want them to do an app with us because we think there's a layer of content and a layer of branding that we can, that their own branded app can provide that they can't get in other places. But we don't say, don't be on TuneIn.
Right.
Don't be on iHeartRadio. We say, yes, definitely be there. And those aggregated environments are really important, and they serve an incredibly important function, a couple of them, in fact. One is for the more casual fans, a place where they can go. They don't have to commit to downloading an app and all that kind of stuff. But also, it's an incredible discovery engine and a place for people to find more content. And out of all the stuff that they discover, some percentage of that, they may say, okay, I want more from this person, or I want more from this brand. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to download their app, and then I have it right there. But I think those aggregated environments provide a really important, service. And we do a lot of apps that do have that element to them, where they're aggregating a lot of different streams and a lot of different content.
You know, Rob, content we have.
Yeah.
You know, and but I think, to my point of view, if I was to do an app for specifically for this, Geek News Central is not necessarily the brand. You know, matter of fact, we're breaking out the brand. We're taking New Media Show to its own website. The Gadget Professor will have their own dedicated landing page. You know, Geek News Central will still curate everything on the main site, but we still want to focus people to taking them to over to the New Media Show site. So then what is the challenge there? Do I need an upper level? Do I need to develop a new upper level network strategy to consolidate everything up? You know, I thought about this during this design, but I thought I would still leave GNC as a header. You know, the mainline show, because, you know, there's 13,000 articles on the website. So it's got some, you know, some Google juice, and didn't really want to regulate it or push it down into a secondary position. So it is a bit of a challenge, and you can really screw this up if you don't do it right the first time.
Yeah, and I think that there's a spectrum here, and I know I've mentioned that a little bit before, but let me go into it a little bit deeper. Is that I think that that these aggregators, you know, iTunes and those type of software platforms are really great for finding new audiences and engaging kind of casual users of podcasts or new media. And but the apps are for the real hardcore fans, or the ones that are really deep in this. And that's always going to be a subset of the overall audience.
True.
And you can't just go one or the other. I think you have to have a true syndication strategy. And Bob, you know, kind of alluded to this, that be everywhere. And I think that's the big picture. And, but don't go into an app thinking that that's going to be, you know, 80 or 70% of your audience is going to migrate there. So, you know, it is a value equation. I mean, what percentage of your audience can you drive to your app to create a deeper engagement with them? And is that number going to be high enough to justify the investment in the app? I think that's the reasonable thought process that I go through with it.
Yeah, I agree too. So, you know, is there, and I was looking at your guys' client list, and you guys have definitely done a lot of work with a lot of people, a lot of mainstream names I've seen there. So if a podcaster is coming over to talk with you folks to work on an app, what is the, you know, kind of what is your guys' internal process? What should someone expect when they were going to come over and work with Jake Apps?
Our process is really, you know, we want to look at what's the audience, what are the audience needs, and where are they, you know, what are they trying to accomplish? I mean, we always have to start from the goals. I mean, with, you know, with some of our clients with radio stations, things like that, they have certain sort of brands within a brand that they really need to kind of go after and grow. So for instance, you know, like with morning shows and things like that, what we really try to do is is bring that stuff together for them in a place where they can really, you know, where they can leverage that audience, because they have what in the radio business they call P1s, which are your most passionate audience members. And they're the ones you really want to go after. And I think that that's the key element is to figure out what that is. So, you know, for our non-radio clients, the needs can be very different. You know, we just talked to somebody this week. They're looking for something in the B2B space. They want a system where they can talk to their sales reps out in the world in a very real-time way. And so they have a different set of needs. So we always start from the position of what are the requirements and is there an audience? So first of all, do you have the material that you want to send to that you need to get to that audience? And second of all, do you have an audience that is, you know, that really needs it and is willing to take that step to download an app and give you that little piece of their home, of their palm top?
And I know you probably don't like talking about pricing, but is there a, you know, let's just say I came to you guys and say, hey, I want to do a podcast app. It's going to have, three or four properties in it. I'm going to have some of it will be strictly podcast material. The other part will be web syndication and, you know, really, stuff that's on the website now. Is there a rough ballpark what the figure is these days to, and I guess it depends also on the number of devices, but.
It depends on a couple different things. I mean, obviously, it depends on how many platforms, you know, do you need to be on. You know, typically we sell iPhone and Android. Those are the most popular platforms, you know, by quite a stretch. And so that's really the focus. The second thing is what are all the pieces that are in it? I mean, some things require back-end content management. Some things require database. Some things require integration with things like XML feeds. And all of those things kind of impact the price of the app. The other thing too is, you know, we focus on a lot of, you know, on verticals. And with those specific verticals, what we're able to do is we're able to really create, you know, a very templated type app so that you can bring your own branding to it, your own, you know, color palettes and, you know, imagery and things like that. But it's a platform. And obviously, if there's a platform involved, then that's, you know, that definitely is a cost savings for our clients. But, you know, there's something one of our engineers found on the web. Client comes in and says, you know, how much does it cost to make an app? And the developer says, about as much as a car. And it's, the client says, what kind of car? And the developer says, exactly. So that's really, you know, from a cost perspective, that's really what it is. You know, are we talking about, you know, a Ford Focus or a Bentley? At JCAPS, we've built both. For our radio clients, we can do really well with that Ford Focus and something that's very, you know, mass produced. And a lot of what our developers have been doing lately is creating a platform that is much more modular and flexible. So what we're trying to do is make that platform app much more customizable and able to, you know, going from sort of a, you know, what we were doing 2 years ago, which was a very much a one-size-fits-all model, to something where you really can tailor the app to your needs.
One of the, in the chat room, and this is the gentleman that built the Android app for me, he says, I just looked up my emails from Todd back in 2010. At the time, he thought they could use something called iBuild app to put the GNC content on mobile devices. My thought at the time was, the tool created a mobile website. Maybe Todd was rethinking the native app because he was struggling to get the guy to finish the iOS app at the time. What is Bob's opinion regarding creating native apps versus mobile? And I will say this before you answer that, the new website design that I'm doing is responsive. So if someone comes in with a mobile browser, they're going to get a pretty good mobile experience. But can you speak to the?
I'd love to speak to that because I answer that question all the time. And it's a very I think it's an interesting question. Things like responsive design and HTML5 have really moved the state of the art forward in a lot of ways and allow people to get a lot more content to our to an app, into a native app. But that native app is still really important. And there's a few reasons for that. One, as I said before, is because you want that beachfront property. You want to be on that palm top. To be one of, you know, a billion websites, to be, you know, looked up on the mobile web is not a great place to be. It's hard enough to find stuff, you know, searching on your desktop. But when you're, you know, trying to type in long URLs on your phone, it's really very inconvenient. The second thing is, you know, for that audience that really wants your content, you want to be right there. You want to be top of mind. You want to be something that they look at all the time. We show a chart all the time that shows, you know, the number of apps that are used once, and that ends up being somewhere around 30% of all apps, 35% of all apps get used once. Then as you go, apps that were used twice, three times, four times, five times, the number gets smaller and smaller and smaller until you get to 11. And that 11th use, it jumps back up to 25%. And so what it really means is that once an app becomes a habit, then you really, you know, you've locked in with that user. And we, what we want users to do is come up with a real way, you know, to get to that point of being a habit. The other thing about native apps that I think is really important to remember is that when you do a native app, you have access to a lot of the functionality within the mobile OS. And in that mobile OS, there's all kinds of great things you can do there, whether it's accessing mapping, location services, the phone's camera and microphone. Those are all things that you can do in a native environment that you can't do on the mobile web. So what we always tell people is, you know, you have to look at your needs and the needs of your audience and how do those things go together. And from that, you know, you decide to do, you know, an app. I mean, we tell people all the time, you don't need an app. I mean, you know, we've done that. The other thing that's great about all these other, these mobile web and responsive design is it makes it much easier to bring content from the website into the native app so that you really can think about your website and your app as sort of two separate experiences that you can then adjust and use, you know, and borrow from each one as it makes sense.
You know, one of my listeners had suggested a couple of years ago that, you know, type in geeknewscentral.com, and as you said, in the app sucks, so I bought the domain gnc.io. So really what it allows people to do is, you know, and I was lucky enough to be able to buy that app or buy that domain, so now people want to get to, and that's kind of a stopgap measure that I use to help people get to the website, and it's kind of like geeknewscentral.in and out. So you get in, get out, gnc.io, as and basically all it is just a redirect to the main website. But again, I've seen some domains that are like, you know, that long now, and you're trying to figure out how in the heck am I, you just Google them. You don't even really, you know, type in the domain on the mobile device. Rob, go ahead. I've been hogging the mic here.
That's okay. Yeah, it seems like we're kind of in this this phase where we're still trying to decide whether or not, as a online kind of user community globally, are we gonna move more and more, you know, away from the web and move more into native apps. Bob, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. I mean, where do you think, as you look out maybe a couple of years from now or 3 or 5 years from now, how do you see the app kind of landscape changing versus the web? Do you see it being very similar?
I think what you'll see with HTML5 and responsive design and the rise of, you know, responsive websites, I think what you'll see is a real blurring of the lines. I think you'll see less definition between those two things. And, you know, a mobile app will be for the very specific, you know, will be for specific purposes in a lot of cases. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we had someone come to us not too long ago and said, hey, we want to do we've got a responsive site for our TV station, and we just want to put it into a native shell. And I mean, we had to tell them we couldn't do it because very simply, Apple won't approve an app that is just a shell. They really want there to be functionality in there. They want there to be content in there that is unique to that app environment. But I think what you'll see with these two kind of opposing forces is that there will be a real, I think, merging ultimately. I think these two things will start. You'll start to see the lines blur, and you'll see, I mean, we're already seeing it. We just are working on an app right now where there was a significant portion of the app that they didn't really want to, or of their content that they didn't want to recreate in the app because it meant a lot of work on the back end. And they were able to make those screens responsive. We pull them straight into the app. It's completely seamless to the user. The user's able to do multiple things. You know, they're able to listen to the station simultaneously while they're able to look at images and vote on images and things like that. So I think you'll see, you know, over time that the lines between mobile web and apps blurring, and each will kind of find their place. I mean, I sort of see it. The app is going to be sort of a layer of function whereby things like location and stuff like that become very important. But then for depth, you know, nothing does depth better than the web. And I think that's how you'll see those pieces come together.
One of the companies in the podcasting space was originally creating standalone apps. And I think they were just basically cookie cutter apps. They use the same templating, and you know, all they had to do is pick the colors, graphics, and you know, they pre-populated them, turn on some modules. And they got to 400 or 500 installs, and Apple shut them down. They didn't let them submit any more individual apps. They required them to go back and build a shell, and then you have to download one app, and that's kind of, and then you have to add the shows in that network. And to me, I'm thinking to myself, that is the most stupid thing in the world, because it's a two-step process. It's hard enough to get people to do one thing, but asking them to download this, then access that, you know, they just want it to work.
Yeah. I think Apple sometimes, you know, can be their own worst enemy with some of that stuff. I mean, if you look at what Apple did with iTunes, the reason iTunes worked and, you know, ate the record industry alive was because they did exactly what you're describing. They made it so easy. You know, your average music fan, you know, wasn't going to deal with finding MP3s on Napster or on some torrent site. But all of a sudden, boom, there it is. It's right there in front of you. Sure, I'll pay 99 cents for that song. I don't care. And I think it's the same thing with apps. I think you really have to, you have to give the user something for that commitment, even if it's a free app. And I think, you know, as we move forward, most apps will be free, already are. You have to give the user something for that, to make that commitment to you, to put, you know, for them to put you, you know, onto their screen. You got to really give them something. But I think that one of the challenges is everything moves so fast, and particularly with content and needing to be everywhere, you have to be able to, you know, be flexible. And I think that's where some of the great stuff that you can do with responsive design really comes into play. And you're able to add layers of content and depth of content and begin to unify those experiences. I just talked to someone yesterday whose entire business model is around unifying the experience from platform to platform and making it really easy. Because the last thing you want to do is have somebody have to relearn something because they went from your website to your mobile app. I mean, it should be, you know, the experience should really strive to be seamless.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, the challenge is that, you know, people have to have a very well thought out strategy. And it, you know, the biggest challenge I have many times, and when I go to, you know, looking at content creator sites, is they have absolutely, you know, they put a lot of heart and soul into the content, but they've thought nothing about their website. And then you go to their website and it's absolutely a horrific experience. You know, it's like the guy's a media creator and you can't even find the media on the, you know, the front page of the website. And, you know, what kind of insanity is that? You know, the guy's supposed to be a place where, you know, he's supposed to be, you know, have video or audio. And he's, if because we all know the bounce rates on web pages. You just look at Google Analytics, and you know, people, if you don't, you know, you got like 5 seconds maybe, and if they don't see what they're looking for, they're gone. They just have too much to do. And, you know, I think, though, you know, that's talking about the web, but this, you know, you're talking about the stickiness of people using an app after 11 times. It's kind of an interesting number to me.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. That's the number that they came to. But I do, I think that's, you know, it is an interesting thing. The other thing that we're seeing, which is interesting on the statistics side, is the number of apps that users are using every day has trended steadily upwards.
Really?
And so people are using apps now, and also the amount of time spent on like the top, you know, 10% of apps out there has actually declined a little bit. And what this is really saying is that people are using their smartphones for more and more purposes. It is really becoming, you know, it really has become the Swiss Army knife of the 21st century. And so that's an opportunity for people, you know, making apps and creating, you know, various, you know, services and utilities, because people are open to it. And, you know, there are things that are, you know, that I think in the past, you know, were really difficult. I mean, just to give an example, I've just recently moved. You know, my family and I've been looking at houses, and I'm telling you, I look at my Zillow app every day. And it's a real tool for me right now. It's right. Something that I use every day, and it shows its utility every time. It tells me that, oh, the price on that house you were looking at went down, or there's an open house, or whatever it is. And I think that's where app creators and media creators in general really have to be thinking is, how do I get into that user's everyday flow? How do I become that indispensable thing that they want to go to, you know, every day?
You know, it's something I've seen over the years. You know, I've done 944 episodes of my regular show. This is episode 45 of this specific show. And it really, you know, it took when I first started to, you know, get to about show 100 or so, about a year, it took for people to know, or for finally to kind of get in their head, yes, Todd will be coming out with a new show Monday and Thursday. And what I would see in my statistics is, if I was steady, boom, 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 the audience continued to grow. But the second I missed a show, and I went many years without missing a show, the second I missed a show, then I would take a drop. And it took me a while to get that audience back, because, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. You have to be, it's almost, you know, it's, you're getting them, you know, I don't like to say this, but conditioned, or they build you into their life and they want to come back, and they're expecting that media to be there at a certain time during a day, and they built that into it, their schedules. So
yeah, human beings are fundamentally creatures of habit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, so for me, it's, I understand that completely about, you know, having a certain use pattern. You know, and I used to travel quite a bit. I'm not traveling as much now by choice. But, you know, when I travel, I use Yelp. I don't use Yelp when I'm home, because I know where all the restaurants are that I like to go eat. And when I'm traveling, I'm always trying to explore. So I use that app. And it doesn't, you know, so it is, and there are use patterns. And I'm sure Yelp is very happy when I use my app when I'm traveling. I'm sure they wish I used it more when I'm home, but I don't need to. But I can imagine, like you said, the Zillow app when you're shopping for a home. But what if you're shopping for a podcast? You know, again, I don't know if that exactly translates, but, you know, we've weighed whether or not we need to build a network app or not. And I think we're pretty much at the point where we say we need to. But personally, I got to really think about this more, about building an app for this show. And I'm sure the people that are listening are running that through their head too. I think what would make it easier is most folks that are in this space, you know, there's three categories of folks. There's the hobbyist. There's the guy that's doing their show a little bit to make a little money there. You know, they do have some business savvy, and then, you know, they're trying to build a brand. And the third person is really that hardcore professional that is building networks, and, you know, he's actively involved day to day. Those guys are easy sell. How do I get that middle ground folks that don't have maybe necessarily a lot of discretionary income? how do we get them started with an app that's not going to, you know, it's not going to cost them the cost of a car to deploy?
Well, I think the key thing there is, you know, bringing together things that are like and that, you know, offer variations or different, you know, perspectives and opinions on things, I think is a great way to do it. And if you have, you know, long time ago, I used to work in the movie business and they talked about tentpole movies. And if you have a tentpole podcast and you have one that has a large number of followers, I think it's a really logical thing to go and find that second tier and say, okay, we're going to bring together the best of that second tier. And I, as sort of the tentpole brand, I'm going to use, you know, my influence and my esteem with my listeners to refer them to other things. I mean, I think, you know, you see it all the time in other media. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I was talking with some people yesterday. I mean, if you look at all of the talent that has spun off of The Daily Show right. In the last 3 or 4 years, it's incredible, you know. And so they start with that tentpole, that established product, and then you bring in the other people, and they're the ones that build it out. They're the ones that can, in some ways, I think, get the end user over that sort of reluctance. Well, do I download this? Do I give it, you know, the space on my phone? And I think if they say, well, you know I love this guy and he's good and he's there every week and his content is always great and he's brought in 3 or 4 other guys. Well, now, okay, there's enough there. And I'm able to look at that as my source for this particular topic. I think that's really the key. And so I think, you know, you start with that main audience draw that you know you have. You've created a real value proposition to the audience, and now you're going to build it out with other content. And I think that's going to then make all of those things kind of rise. And who knows, maybe one of those second tier ones that comes in, maybe he starts doing it more regularly. He builds his own fan base. He starts to kind of go off in a more specific direction. Then that can kind of spawn the next app or that next, you know, that kind of that next brand.
Rob, we're going to lose Bob here in a few minutes, so I'm going to let you go ahead and if you got some final questions for him.
Yeah, well, yeah, I just wanted to kind of throw out this thought. I've been thinking about, you know, where do we see this going as far as apps and the operating system? So as you think about, yeah, I've noticed that on the Windows Phone platform, I'm a Windows Phone user, that apps are starting to be kind of the same thing for adding features and functionality to mobile devices and the operating system. Like I'll get a app update for my phone that's basically, you know, some functional aspect of the operating system, like tools or, I mean, it feels like that this apps model is making all of our devices kind of adding more capability to the actual device. So you start thinking about, well, how do we take these apps and instead of making them almost like siloed experiences, take those experiences and have them somehow kind of plug into the operating system and to add features to the experience instead of having almost like standalone apps, right? And I know that the Windows Phone folks tried to do that with the concept of hubs, where it, yeah, so you load in a type of app and it basically pulls data from that app and displays it in this one kind of area on the phone, right? That pulls in Twitter and pulls in Facebook and pulls in all those and creates one experience. And I think it's an interesting thing that they're actually moving away from that because I guess, you know, a lot of the app developers never enabled that capability for those apps to communicate in a unified way. And I think it's a really kind of big question for the future of apps is, I mean, are we going to continue to live in these separate silos of, you know, app experiences where we're opening and closing and opening and closing, or are we going to move into a world where apps basically plug in and add capability to the operating system?
I don't know. I think we get I think we may start to see more of that. I know one of the things that I'm seeing, and this is, you know, this may be a leading indicator on this. one of the most popular features that we're adding to apps right now is push notification. So one of the things that I think people really want to do now is, people being app developers and the media creators, is they want to push up. You know, I mean, right now they're basically a static icon on that user's screen. And, you know, I always say that, you know, the little red number that pops up on that icon is one of the most powerful things out there, because, you know, we have a guy in our office who's like Pavlovian. Like, if one of those things pops up, he has to go see what it is right away.
Just to hit it, right? Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that you'll see is a real desire on the part of app creators. I think it may almost go the opposite direction of what Microsoft did, where app creators are going to say, we want access to a layer above our app on a menu. We want access to be able to push things in. So that, I think, is really, I think that's something you're going to see. I think we haven't figured it out yet, and I don't think we've figured out yet what the consumer behavior is behind it, but I think we will pretty soon.
Yeah, so I think that really what you're saying is that notification area is going to become more and more kind of key to how people kind of plug into their apps, right? It's almost like a main page for everything that you might want to do in your phone.
It's going to be almost like a real-time feed of, hey, here's something new, you know? So if I've got the, Geek News Central app, you know, on my phone, it's like, hey, there's a new story here, you should check this out. Or, hey, there's a break, you know, you get breaking news from certain sites, things like that. And the problem now is they all kind of come in this sort of chaotic way. And I think people are going to want to look at how do you organize that? And I think that the OS developers are gonna sort that out.
And I know you got to go, but I'll tell you one thing that really irritated me was Facebook removing the chat and putting into Messenger and forcing you over there, making me have two apps. It really pissed me off. I'm like,
yeah, I totally agree. I don't like that either.
You know, it's just, to me, it's like, okay, I like an integrated experience. And if I click something and I know it's going to do something, that's cool. But I don't want to be forced into a new ecosystem.
I totally agree. Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Yeah. This has really been fun.
And folks, if you're interested in checking out the company, actually, let me load the page up here. It's jacapps.com.
And that's right. Jake Apps. I'm Make Apps.
And I'm sure they would be happy to put you up a quote for putting up an app. And let's talk next week. Maybe we can do a sale here.
Great. Would love to. Look forward to talking to you. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Bob. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm still, you know, you know what kills me, Rob, is the numbers.
I know.
You know, the number of users, if I knew I could move 10% of the audience to an app or get 10%, you know, it's, you know, he's one of many companies that make apps. And he scares me when he says a small car to roll out an app. That's probably out of most content creators. It's not out of a radio station's price point, but definitely outside of the price range I'm looking to spend.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you want to have, you know, advanced capabilities in your app, it's not going to be cheap or inexpensive, though. I think over time, you know, technology progresses, right? And capabilities come at lower and lower costs. Right. And I think that the Android and the iOS and the Windows Phone kind of dev tools are going to get better and better, and it's going to be cheaper to add capabilities. I mean, really, I think it has to get to be almost like what it was with the web. You know, the early web, where people could create these things fairly easily and build them out and add capabilities and things like that. It's just that the tools are just not that mature yet. You know, a kind of a good example of this is what's happening with Windows, where they're really aggressively trying to create one development tool that will develop for all those devices and have it be where all the capabilities and components and the APIs and all those things like that are built into the dev tools, and it's just like a drag and drop kind of thing. And then, you know, the whole skinning of it is really, I think, where the challenge should be. And that's the way it was with the web too. And people shared components and that's what built it. So I think that the apps I'm starting to really believe are where all of us should be putting more and more of our thoughts and energies. And I mean, I don't necessarily like it, because I've been a big fan of the web over the years and would have liked to have seen the capability of the web get better and better. But the problem is that we're coming into a new time and a new age of technology, and it's all about context, and it's all about sensors, and it's all about understanding the world and the place that you are and your location, and getting real-time data to you that you need to make decisions. And I mean, because our phones are going to be, like our personal assistants. They're going to advise us. They're going to tell us what's going on around us. They're going to let us know who we're around. I mean, there's just so much more capability. And in order to tap into those APIs, you have to have, you have to have a native app. So I think that's just where it's going.
And, I think the challenge that we're going to run into is that all that's cool, but it comes at a pretty high price at this
cost.
It's absolutely crazy on, the amount of money that you can spend to add some of these features. The push notification is cool, but there's other ways to do that too. If you've got a responsive design website, you can add a plugin to WordPress, and on every, post in a certain category, it sends a signal to the push site, and it'll send a text message to your subscribers. So, so there's 25 different ways to skin a cat. I guess the main point is that over time, I'm sure this is going to become a lot cheaper for folks. And, I've seen some models too that have some pretty strong apps that are in the $50 or $60 a month range, with maybe an initial investment of $1,000 or something. But still, there's only going to be a small percentage of content creators that I work with that'd be willing to spend that kind of money.
Yeah. And those are the folks that they're going to put out content that's available, primarily in the big, aggregator platforms, the iTunes and and Stitchers and SoundCloud. Those are places that are easy for people to publish content. And I also think that with the new phones and the new kind of software platforms that I think are coming, is it's going to be a lot easier for people to produce content right on their phones and push them out right through their phones. And it's just going to be a lot easier. It's not going to be as difficult as it's been in the past to be a content creator.
And I think too, discovery is, pretty easy at this point, but, it's like we're talking last week about what Bing did and with their app. And I'm really, wondering how that strategy is going to work out. When is that app actually going to be available? Is it available for Windows 8.1 users now?
No, it's not. It's only available for developers. I mean, really anyone can get it, but it's primarily targeted towards developers and I think the press. There is a page on the Windows Phone website, I believe, that you can get access to the bits to load on your phone. But I believe most are going to wait until it's officially pushed out by the carriers, which will happen over a period of the next few months. Different phones will get upgraded, and it's not going to happen all at once. From what I understand, I don't really know for sure, but I am trying to get a meeting at Microsoft to have them share with me the exact plan that they have for content providers to get their shows in Bing. So far, the folks that I've talked to about it haven't been able to communicate that in a clear and concise way. So
surprise.
Yeah. So I believe in the next week or so, I'm going to be having a meeting. I'll be up in Redmond for another purpose, and hopefully I'll be able to sit down with the folks from Bing and Windows Phone, and they'll explain to me how that process could work or should work.
you know, it was last week was the week of meetings. It was just, I told you when we closed the last show that we'd had an influx of certain type of clients calling us. And it was a pretty insane last week. My head still actually hurts because I spent like 3 days, maybe 4 days in GoToMeeting. It's like, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, boom, 45 minutes to an hour, boom. It's great. But I've never done a marathon week of GoToMeeting sessions. I don't want to have to do it again anytime soon.
Yeah, it's can be grueling. I'm sure
grueling isn't even the word for it. And you know, and what we find, what I find, and is that, and this was pretty typical. I can probably say it. We're talking with radio stations and the tech guys and the consultants all understood 100% what we were bringing to the table and offering. But the owners of the stations were many times quite a bit older. I was really surprised at the age of the executives. There was largely a 60 and above crowd that we were talking to last week from an owner standpoint. And so we had to spend, you know, a good 15 minutes of every meeting. And we learned this real quick of, you know, I had to, the geeks were on board. They understood exactly. And it was, you know, they weren't even the ones we were selling. We had to sell the boss because the geeks were already sold. The bosses were, you know, this whole thing about, you know, they do shoutcast streaming and they have their podcast offerings and they have the linear stuff that's live. You know, basically that to them, they have a hard time determining the difference between, or they had a lot of time differentiating the difference between someone that would go to their shoutcast server and you know, tune in live to someone that was doing on demand. And, you know, using the on-demand type of discussion and DVR style listing really kind of helped clear that up for many of them, because most folks have a DVR in their house these days. They understand the utility of it. But I was really kind of shocked that these high level, and these are some folks in some pretty big markets, really didn't have a good technical handle on the space. And to me, it just opened my eyes completely, because we've undervalued that entire market. And I can probably spend the rest of this year just talking with with radio stations. But
yeah, I'll bet.
And, you know,
yeah, I mean, those concepts, and I Todd, I 100% agree with you. Those concepts are sometimes difficult for people to really grasp, the fine distinctions between an on-demand stream and an on-demand live stream, or just a live stream and then a download and then a progressive playback download. These are all concepts that are very much similar from a user experience, right? But are technically different. And yeah, I've run into that same challenge, you know, with folks too. It's like, you know, well, what's the difference between, you know, an on-demand stream and podcasting?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, there really isn't, but there is. And so, that can be a challenging discussion.
So one of the things that ended up being, it was pretty cool, was that, you know, the question that was raised real early was, okay, how many shows do you have? And the guy told me. And I said, okay, how many of those shows are syndicated, you know, come from a third-party source where you don't have access to the source material? And they would tell me the percentage. And, you know, because what they're really trying to do is monetize their podcast content. And, my first question was, do you have the rights to rewrite advertising into those shows that you have syndicated, number one? Number two, I know you want to measure them, and many of the folks were syndicating. So, you know, for example, one of the shows was a nationally recognized talk show who has his own website, has his own podcast, but yet the radio station had that same show available for distribution on their own website being fed by a separate RSS feed. So you have the guy's primary location and the, and a second, I'm thinking to myself, my God, if, you know, if the main producer fully understood the impact, he's really not getting the reporting data back on all these stations that are carrying, they're doing their kind of their own thing. And they're well within their right contract wise to put that content out and make it available. But there's, it was real obvious to me that there's a need out there. And so one meeting led from a talk, and basically one network, I mean, one station completely got it and immediately made a call. And within an hour, we were talking with the next level in the chain. We were up one level, and it's going to be pretty incredible what's, I think, is going to develop over this. But they're becoming more, well, the advertisers are now wanting to fill that content, fill that podcast content with advertising. And yep, they are going to the radio stations first, which is a good thing in a big way, because if they're going to buy radio, then it won't be too long before they're going to be buying non-terrestrial podcasters. So, and a lot of money, I mean, it looks to me like a lot of money coming into the scene, but they're going directly to the radio stations, to those buyers they've worked with for years, which is an interesting move.
So is it more local advertisers than it is national advertisers?
No, it's national. The stuff that, the, you know, and that's the thing, you know, we had to have a discussion about too, was that obviously most radio stations do local advertising, the car dealer. Yeah, you know, the supermarket, it's, you know, it's all local, but everything that they were buying was national, because the media buyers understood that the podcast audience was global and it was a micro audience for the locals. So this was national buyers out of New York and some other locations too. So the word has gotten out, and it's so, you know, ultimately it'll end up being more money coming into, you know, companies like yours and mine for ad deals, which is good. You know, we can, and all, all ad revenue is good. But also the vultures are there too, trying to buy the remnant stuff. And, the remnant, you know, basically the guy was listing to me the remnant, advertising, and it was stuff that I would no way in this world ever allow into my content. Just, you know, some of that stuff that's 2 o'clock in the morning, scummy, for a better word, scummy advertising.
Yeah,
or less than question, or less than reliable, products. But it's kind of cool to talk with these folks this week, and so we'll see where it leads. You know, I'm just one piece of their big puzzle, but
yeah, I mean, it's not core to what podcasting is all about. You know, all these radio guys, but the truth of the matter is there's a lot of economics involved in that world. And because radio still is today, you know, a large enterprise, right? Well, I mean, there's a lot of advertisers, there's a lot of listeners, and they have a need to be part of the digital world, and they've gone down that path to some extent. But I think podcasting has been kind of like one of those things that they don't really understand, because it's not like a broadcast model necessarily. It's it's a different model.
Well, to almost to a T, what really kicked much of this off is that some of them were looking at their growing podcast hosting bill. And they were like, you know, I'm spending all this money on delivering media. What am I getting in return?
Yeah.
And that opened the floodgates to, I think it was a couple of consultants that have been making the rounds, and, you know,
podcast and, consultants or radio consultants?
Radio consultants that are helping them move their podcast inventory into, well, basically to monetize it. And so lucky enough, they're fans of us and, you know, have brought us this business. But the thing that, surprised me was the traffic. They're moving an incredible amount of traffic, much more than I would have ever, quite frankly, imagined.
So traffic in regards to listeners or?
Yeah. And that to me was, you know, it just shows that their audience, just as we expected, is shifting. You know, they're not listening. They're listening on their device. They're not listening and they're still listening on the car radio, but they're listening a lot more digital.
Yep.
So, but you know, it's all good. We'll see how it all leads out. But the long story is that we had a damn busy week. God.
I'm working more and more with, talk radio folks. You know, there's a show that I'm going to be adding to our network in the next week or so. That has never had a podcast, and they have a big, national radio show. Yeah. And they never had a podcast. So, you know, I think radio is starting to wake up.
Well, I think what's crazy is that how many markets have how many local shows? You know, I'm kind of isolated here in Hawaii. We have, a number of stations. And most of them are owned by Clear Channel and, you know, a few others. But there's still a huge, huge, huge number of independents. Out there that are, you know, pretty small shops, in the scheme of things. But, I was pretty, been pretty eye open. You wouldn't think that, a small market and let's just use a town, Tallahassee maybe, you know, you look at the population of Tallahassee and how many radio stations are there and how many are independent and how many of those independents have independent shows that are being put out as podcasts, to me has been holy crap. And one of those holy crap moments.
Yeah.
So
I think what we're seeing right now is just an explosion of new content. Yeah. I mean, you just look in iTunes and I know, just based on what I'm seeing and the activity, is that I think that the radio side is just going to bring a huge influx of new shows to the podcasting space.
Yep.
And I also think that then that is going to trigger a increasing explosion of new content that's going to be original to podcasting too, because more and more of those listeners to radio are going to start seeing, the radio side and that huge audience pool that's currently, 80% of audio consumption is still radio. People are going to become much more aware of being able to do on-demand radio, which I think is the term of the future to describe our medium. I think podcasts will always stay kind of in that same realm, but I think the term on-demand radio will start to really take over as the main term to describe this, especially as we see more radio kind of move this direction.
Hey, one thing I wanted to talk about, and this is completely off topic, but it was something I was involved in discussing last night on Facebook, is here in Hawaii, the University of Hawaii has gotten sued by a group. Basically, University of Hawaii has what they call free speech zones. And I didn't know that these types of things existed on universities where students, if they wanted to hand out flyers or, basically stand on a soapbox and make a speech, they have to go to designated boxed in areas where they have, this is where they're allowed to speak publicly and they hand out flyers. So they've gotten sued here in Hawaii for basically they had them stuck over in some non-trafficked area. It wasn't like down an alley or anything, but it was like this area where I thought universities were places you went to expand your mind and have discussions and open debate. And I was just shocked. So they're getting sued for not being allowed to have basically open free speech type of stuff anywhere on the campus. Obviously they wouldn't do it in a classroom, but what is wrong with our country that is making a free, I thought if I live in the United States, I can pretty much say anything I want anytime, anywhere. Now there can be consequences to that. Don't get me wrong.
That's the other side to it.
If I go into a courtroom and I yell at a judge, I'm probably going to end up condemned to court and in jail. You know, but or if I, you know, if I act up during some sort of, you know, I may get arrested. I can still do that, and I probably will not be shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess what's going to be next? Are the universities going to start taking pictures, taking names, and building lists of organizations on campuses? I'm just flabbergasted, to be honest with you.
Well, you know, free speech is a right, right, by the Constitution,
but that doesn't
necessarily give you the right to offend and deceive or be kind of disrespectful. And I think there's consequences for all those things.
Well, there is, but if you are being respectful and not, you know, but the thing is, what would you have done if they told you when you went to college you could only have, this is the area, this is the little box you have to stand as a free speech zone? Would that have flabbergasted you a little bit?
Yeah, that was never something that I ever thought would ever happen at an institution of higher learning.
Well, you know, in the 60s, if they would have had free speech zones,
why do they feel like they need to do that? Are people or students starting to protest and get in people's faces and all over the campus? And what are they standing up for? And I guess the bigger question is, maybe those colleges and universities are concerned about their reputations.
Well, you know, I understand that hate speech and all that stuff is, you know, as much as I served 24 years in the Navy, and I truly believe that I believe in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. So is as much as I hate and am disgusted by like skinheads and the KKK and all those hate groups, they still have a right to say what they want to say, as much as it pisses me off. But at the same time, I have the right to protest them. What this group was doing was, you know, this should not come as a surprise. I live in Hawaii. It's pretty left. Is they were handing out U.S. Constitution, and that was basically deemed inappropriate behavior, and they were supposed to go to the free speech zone. So obviously, it's gotten people pretty riled up here. Mm-hmm. A school in California tried to do this as well, and end up settling for $50,000 to pay the lawsuit off. But we'll see what happens. But you know, I guess I can understand a university's position on wanting to try to make sure that these, you know, some whacked out group doesn't do something stupid, but you know, there should not be, if it's not, I don't know. I just, it just bothers me. It really does. And I don't know if there's any clear answer, but.
Well, you can always start your own online show and say whatever you want, right?
That's right. That's true. That's true. they can do that. But, if they're going to stifle debate on a university.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, it makes me
This past week, the Electronic Frontier Foundation put out some information about how they got the go-ahead to challenge the podcast patent.
Yeah, the lawsuit is moving forward, I guess. Or not the lawsuit, but the challenge.
Challenge to the patent.
Yeah. Yep.
To the validity of the patent. And it's being challenged, and I guess some precedent was kind of recognized as kind of a key part of that, right? The things that were submitted in the initial petition about pre-existing art. I mean, essentially, I guess the patent board or committee or whatever reviewed that and made some determinations that there was some significant there to take it to a full hearing, which hasn't happened yet.
And there's a timeline. Now, the EFF put out basically what it boils down to. The Patent Trial and Appeals Board, PTAB, has found that the EFS has provided sufficient prior art evidence in its case against the podcast patent. Now, what happens now is a predetermined timeline. They have hurdles they have to hit. The EFF has to file paperwork. Personal Audio has to file paperwork. And it's a back and forth process. We should have I don't know if we get a final ruling, but the legal part will be done about December. the timeline takes it all the way out to like 17 December. And from there, I don't know if the patent office comes back and says, yeah, the patent is invalidated or not. But it's called the IPR process. And basically, it provides an expedited means for the patent office to take a second look at a patent is already issued. The kind of challenge proceeds in two steps. First, they file the petition, which they've been approved. Then, before the IPR actually goes forward, the PTAB must decide whether the petition established a reasonable likelihood that would prevail. They say they have. And then, basically, this moves into this next step. And there's on the EFF website, there's a full write-up of this and the timeline and everything. So we'll see where this leads.
Yeah, I still wonder if they're going to come back and want another round of donations as you move into this next phase.
Well, if they do, that's the community stepped up the first time. We'll see if they step up the second time.
Yeah.
If they smart, yeah. They would.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would raise a lot of attention. I know, Mr. Adam Carolla has been doing quite a bit of that here over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, how much money has he raised?
I haven't seen the latest number, but I know he was quite a bit higher than what the Electronic Frontier Foundation raised, that's for sure. Of course, Adam's been crazily on podcasts here over the last, it's amazing how many shows he's been on.
He doesn't, he has to pay his lawyers. He doesn't have lawyers that do stuff pro bono.
Yep.
So he's raised $365,000.
Has he? Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's like almost four times what the Electronic Frontier Foundation raised, yeah. Right?
And the Frontier Foundation basically had to cover just cost. They didn't have, any profit built into, the fee. But that's still, he doesn't have $365,000. That is just he probably needs four times that much money.
Yeah, I think he was shooting for over $1 million, I think.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So 1,384 people. Well, how many people contributed, does it say? About 13, 17, 3,200, 4,100, 42, 43, no, 51. Looks like about 5,100 people have donated.
Well, so if he can keep...
Oh, 9,875, 9,875 contributions.
Yeah. So if he can keep it in litigation up through December, I don't know if a decision by the patent board would help him. I'm sure it probably would.
Yeah, I would imagine it would help him big time. If the patent's invalidated.
Yep. So if he can keep things in play until the patent office makes a determination here. He may not have to go all the way on this.
Right. So, well, we'll see. In for penny, in for pound, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
But so it's interesting, though. They had a couple of things that they didn't. DFF had like three prior art challenges, and one of them was thrown out. I think they're going to go back and appeal that.
Yeah.
Overall, it looks the post was pretty positive.
Back when they were soliciting those prior art, I mean, yeah, I submitted a couple of prior art things that I knew about that were kind of not directly related, but at least a little bit related. I read through a lot of the prior art in there, and there is quite a bit. I was actually surprised. Because you had to go back to like 1996,
right,
or earlier, which was really interesting because podcasting wasn't even, the concept of it couldn't really have existed back then.
Yep.
And I think at the core, I think that's the big issue. And I think Dave Weiner actually raised that point just a week ago or so, that how could there have been a podcasting patent before podcasting started?
Well, they don't claim it's Personal Audio's patent challenge, I believe, revolves around something to do with cassette subscriptions or like that. Yeah.
Well, it's the process of it, right? Of taking content and putting it out, you know.
Right.
But he came up with a design for what could have been construed as podcasting before he actually was ever doing it, and he never actually did it. Which is interesting.
So, you know, of course, Personal Audio has been responding all over the place to this as well. I saw a couple of things that they had said. But, you know, basically, Personal Audio will have another opportunity to present evidence and defend its patents before the PTAB makes its final decision. And let's see if I can find. So basically, they are hoping that they're able to get it invalidated or narrowed. The current basically that's what their goal is, and you know, I guess we should all be happy the EFF has stood up to battle this, so we'll see where it leads.
I think it is a pretty significant threat to the space.
Well, you know, I think as they come out and ask for money, it's like people will fold. You know, they just won't be able to afford to do what they're doing, and you know, it'll be bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not that much. You know, they went after the big folks, but there's not that much money in the space. You know, but I guess every little bit counts. That's the way they look at it, I guess.
But I think over time, I think there is going to be a lot of money in the space.
Going forward, yeah, potentially, yes.
Yeah, so. I think we're clearly on that path to being kind of a replacement medium for radio today. So just think about all those revenues that are coming into radio today, starting to shift over.
Hey, I don't know if I told you on the last show, but I got a great deal on eBay. I was looking to replace
a camera. I think you have talked about that.
Yeah, so it came, and you know, this is the best deal I've ever made on eBay. And he even sent, this is like a $180 Canon battery. So, you know, I didn't expect him to send that, but he sent that and some extra attachments, and so I did really well on this particular eBay thing. And, you know, this is a $1,400, $1,500 camera, and I got it for less than half.
So where are you going to use that? Are you going to use it in the studio there?
Let me show you where it's going to go. There.
Okay.
Yeah, that camera is not wanting to focus, so it's c'est la vie.
History. Huh?
Yeah, and it's done. I've got two HDMI to SDI converters that are actually, I got to pick up in the post office today. For some reason, Amazon sent them USPS. I don't know. That's the first time I ever got something from Amazon via the post office, but I guess that was the cheapest way to send them for free with the Prime.
Hey, so you didn't go to the National Association of Broadcasters event this year, so I didn't get a chance to hear about anything cool as far as tech that came out of that show this year. Did you hear anything?
Yeah, and matter of fact, if you go and review like the last 2 weeks of material on Geek News Central, there's a lot of it. And let me actually bring up a couple of things and we can take us through the end of the show here. Come on, close this.
Yeah, because I, you know, like last year, I mean, you were live streaming from there and doing all this stuff, and you had all these guests on. And
yeah, Don did that. He went. Let's see here.
Okay, and he did all that this year.
Yeah, he did all of it. Let's see. Let's scroll down. Nope. Must be older articles. Let me slip back. And there's a bunch of stuff on the website here. Let's see here. Livestream reveals some product updates. They had a live stream for Glass. They had this beautiful brand new studio surface control unit that just absolutely, let's see if I can show you a picture of it. It's like something right out of Star Wars. This is what it looks like. It's a video switcher that they came out with, which is...
Oh, this is...
that's Livestream.
What company again? Oh, this Livestream.
Yeah, that's
and right. And that's the actual streamer or that's just the controller?
That's the controller. Still has to go through through a computer, but nonetheless, it's pretty sweet from a design stuff. Telestream announced a whole bunch of stuff, not a lot with Wirecast, but a little bit, some updates and so forth. Contour is back in the POV market, basically the Contour cameras. They're back, which is a pretty big deal. Let's see, what else do I have? And I'm loading pages here. Langley went to WonderCon and put a bunch of WonderCon images up on the website. Let's see here. Solo Shot. This is one of the most exciting cameras to me. And I saw this before. Let's talk a little bit about Solo Shot. So what Solo Shot does is you mount it to a tripod and then you put the little sensor in your pocket or attach it to your body. And as you move, the Solo Shot will follow you. And what you can mount on Solo Shot is you can actually put a camera on top of that. And it will basically act as a robot cameraman.
Oh, okay. So it uses like radar or something like that?
Well, I don't know exactly what they use, but it basically lets you, you can be up to 2,000 feet away and it will keep you centered.
Oh, and yeah, I think I've seen this kind of technology before.
Yeah, this is pretty slick and the price point on this is not bad. I think it's under $500. Mushroom Networks has joined the New Tech Developer Network. So what's going on with New Tech now is they are introducing lots of plugins for, you know, like the devices I use to stream this show. Sennheiser has unveiled a new MK8 microphone, an update to that. Telestream has introduced some captioning products to help you meet FCC requirements.
I was going to ask about that, if there was anything new on that front.
Yeah, not cheap at all. It's still pretty expensive to do that. Let's see here. What else? CharacterWorks. Now, this is kind of an interesting development. And most folks, you know, if you watch ESPN, you see all the fancy graphics that they throw in and overlays and stuff that lays on top. You know, I can do an overlay here on the show. That's pretty simple. But to have a graphical overlay that's updating and moving, it's dynamic, is much more difficult. And CharacterWorks has come out with a product that's $5,000. And it will run on any laptop or desktop PC. It renders full HD and true 3D dynamic text and graphics in real time. So this is all keyed, and this is pretty impressive. If I had a spare $5,000 laying around, this would be probably the product that I would buy from the show. I did get to beta test this, so I was able to use it in a beta test situation, and ended up being quite impressive. So that was pretty cool. Rabbit TV, they announced some new original programming at NAB. Let's see here. For those that that's more commercial. That won't work for a podcaster. Teradek is the ones that've got the transmitters that will multi-honed, basically hook a camera to it, plug in your SDI or HDMI, and it will broadcast back. You basically can have a system that is designed to do remotes, but they've announced that they have three new transmitters for their Bolt Pro line. Those are probably $2,000 to $3,000 a piece from a cost perspective. What else to see here? Fraunhofer has introduced some new encoding and decoding stuff. 4K was the big thing at the NAB. Everyone was promoting 4K. Actually, 6K is actually making its debut as well. Blackmagic, which I use a lot of their products, rolled out a new range of Ultra HD products. That Studio Camera, DaVinci Resolve, all these are pretty high-end 4K editing systems. I did a couple of reviews and a couple of products that weren't introduced at NAB, the iRig mic and mm-hmm. the iRig HD, the version that actually has a full mic. But LiveView has come out with a new box. It's called the LU500 and the LU Smart HD app as well. It's a mobile app solution for video professional. App brings out LiveView's bonded transmission technology to the phone or iPad, and it combines Wi-Fi and cellular networks in order to reach optimal video playing. So that's kind of cool. That's kind of similar to what the Google Glass thing was. It's only 2.2 pounds. So that should be pretty cool to see what that's going to be. What else? It's a lot of this stuff. You know, the NAB still is a large percentage of high-end items.
Yeah. Well, it's the professional broadcasters, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's going to start to change. I think it has to change.
Yeah.
So do you think that we're going to see high-end video cameras being able to connect to Wi-Fi networks to transmit video live, like up to the cloud?
Well, through a box.
You know, anytime?
Well, you know.
No, but I mean the actual camera itself, right?
I think Sony's got one, but it's a bloggy, I think, that actually connects via a chip in it. And I think it goes straight to YouTube. So I think they've got one. but I don't think there's any. There could be, but, you know, I don't know. That'd be a real niche market that would want to buy that.
The only reason I say that is if you think about how a lot of podcasters currently produce their shows, they have to have have computers and mixers and all this stuff. It would be interesting, you know, if you think about like what's out there with the drop cam, you know, I think it's another example of what I'm talking about, of being able to just put a camera here and it has a microphone, you know, you could plug a microphone into it and it just transmits to your local network and you don't have to have all this other stuff.
Now, one company that did introduce some really cool stuff, and it's more on the production side if you have a studio, is Motu came out with what's called the HDX SDI. What this really does is you can plug multiple audio inputs and an SDI main video feed, and it basically helps with, separating your audio channels and bringing it into the computer for capture on a Mac or on a PC.
Yeah, I have a Motu Mark of the Unicorns in my TV room. It was from my old studio.
Right.
It used FireWire. So it was an outstanding. It's basically a sound card is what it was. It just plugged into my computer and
I'm a big fan of Motu stuff. I've got
some. It's high end professional stuff.
Yeah. And the price isn't too bad. You know, and of course anything under, you know, this box is $8.99 and they got a sister box that goes along with it too. But, you know, I've got my travel kit had Motu stuff in it and it's what I was using for audio capture. Since I've changed my strategy on travel on recording audio now, I'm just going with a small kit. I might have to think about reusing that box somewhere because it is a pretty expensive box just sitting in a case at this point.
Oh, that one that you custom built?
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think I'm going to travel with that much. Well, what I'll do is I'll leave it together for gigs that I have here in Hawaii. If I have some, basically, I've done different robotics events and different streaming events. It's a good four-camera system, so it still works just fine.
So have you started to think at all about CES yet?
No, and I'm projecting I'm going to change my CES strategy this year.
You are?
Okay. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to do a live booth again. The cost is incredible. I bear the brunt of that cost and, the sponsors have been good, but not fantastic. And, it's just, you know, it takes up 2 months of my life and, I can't afford to take 2 months just for one event. So probably what I'll do is I'll go with a couple of people, take a couple of people with me, a camera person and someone to hump gear and maybe go with a small team and do stuff in for my on my own. I don't think I'll be doing another big event again with a group.
So it'd be more like what you used to do before you did the whole live thing.
You know, the live is great. The numbers on live last year were fantastic. We did, I think at the peak, 14 to 18,000 people on the live stream. So the live was good, but the live don't pay the bills. The live is a feature. And
it's an expensive feature too, I'm sure.
It wasn't as bad last year. The folks from Cox came in and reduced the price of bandwidth quite a bit. So I'm thinking about a different strategy this year, and I've already been approached by a couple of companies. Maybe I'll do some live stuff in a booth, independently. Maybe me and Don will do something where we're there, and you know, it's just at this point, to be honest with you, Rob, I'll be 50 this year, and the hump in the year and setting all that stuff up is great. And if someone else wants to do it, fine. But I just don't think I'm going to partake in it. It was a great experience. We've learned a lot. But there needs to be more dollars involved in doing it. And there's so many competing interests there. In the beginning, we were one of a few outlets that were in there as podcasters coming CES. Now, you know, Callie's in there with her team. There's The Verge is there, TechCrunch, Gizmodo. Can I compete with that? No, but we can focus on more personal interviews and that type of stuff and maybe get as much of a bang as we would. The traffic's, we're moving about still on that media alone. We're moving about a half a terabyte of traffic a day. Which is actually down from previous years, but half a terabyte of traffic a day is pretty doggone good when it comes to content that you recorded back in January.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of The Verge, they basically have shut down all their podcast activities.
When was that?
It's been kind of from what I can tell, it's been kind of a phase thing that's been going on for many months now, where they've been
not paying slowly the bills or what?
Kind of shutting down show after show after show. And here, this like 2 weeks ago, they shut down their kind of main show, the show that they basically started podcasting with. It was called The Verge Cast.
Right.
They basically put it on hiatus.
Huh.
Which is code for we're shutting it down.
Yeah.
So now they're not doing any podcasting now.
Hmm.
They basically shut it all down. And I know that the Engadget folks have mostly shut down most of their podcasting activities as well.
So I wonder what they're going to do if they're going to do anything at CES.
I think that they're still going to do, you know, YouTube kind of stuff and kind of video players on their websites and in their apps and things like that.
Right.
But the whole podcasting thing for those guys. And I think, unfortunately, it could be a little bit of a sign of kind of a bigger picture with podcasting is that kind of technology topics and things like that are not as popular in the space now. And I think as we move into a much more of a kind of mainstream penetration for podcasting, that I believe that mainstream type content is going to basically start dominating. And I think we're starting to see the beginnings of that.
Interesting. Well, I need to blow out of here and get out of here. We're already an hour 40. Hard to believe.
Okay.
But
yeah, that's long.
Yeah, it's long. Thanks everybody for being here. And if you've got comments, Rob and I would love an email. Todd or Rob. And that's not one word. It's todd@newmediashow.com or rob@newmediashow.com. Drop us an email. Let us know what you think, who you think we should have on as a guest. We're going to have a guest soon that should be an interesting topic point. You've got Entrepreneur on Fire scheduled, right?
John Dumas is going is going to join us next week.
That could prove to be an interesting... I may have to zip my mouth shut.
Well, I think you have to stay... positive about John, because I do think that he's really passionate about the space, and he has his own, you know, 800 show network that he's building of podcasters. So he's
of entrepreneurs.
Well, whatever they might be, I haven't gone through his whole list, but I know that he's pretty aggressive about the space, and I think it's all good to have guys like that in the space that are good communicators, good marketers. You know, and we'll hear it straight from him.
Oh, yes, we will. I'm sure. And you want a live one. It'll definitely be a live one, I think. It should be good. So hope everybody tunes in.
So, Todd, who else would you like to see on the show at some point? Have you thought about it?
You know, we've run the gamut on a bunch of people. Maybe we could recycle some folks in that have been in before, maybe touch base with some folks. The guy from Wolf... what is his name?
Did we have him on here recently?
Yeah, I don't know if he's maybe it was too recent.
Okay,
but I guess we'll just have to let me do some thinking cap on that. And the rest of you too. Who do you want us to have on? You want us to have more podcasters on, and which podcaster as well? So send us an email. All right, Rob. Thanks for everything, and we'll see you next week.
Okay.
All right, everyone, take care.
Take care, everybody.
See you next time. Aloha.